Always takes me a couple minutes to recover from my church history class and from the fascinating student questions that come up at the end of the hour. So I'm pretty well recovered by now. I hate to start class a minute late, but sometimes after church history I've had to go and get nerve medicine. And I haven't had to do that yet, you know, so far. And I haven't even needed any drugs. But the semester's early yet. Shall we pray? We're thankful today, Father, for your blessings to us. More thankful than we can tell. And glad for the opportunity we have of fellowship and a life of study. Pray you help us to constantly apply our hearts to your word and the understanding of it. And cheer us in the inner man, Lord, with the hope of how we shall serve you and be an honor to you. So bless us, we pray today in this course, in Jesus' name. On our last class, I had come to what I refer to as capital D, the New Testament and its historic background, under Roman numeral something or other, where we talked about the term covenant and all that sort of thing, and the New Testament fulfilling the old, and a lot of things like that. There's a never-ending mass of this material. Mr. Goodman.
On the Bible everywhere. The last reference you have is Revelation 20:15-21.
It's a Washingtoniensis in the expurgated version. 22. Isn't that the chapter I want? 22. Thank you, Mr. Goodman. I meant to mention that a couple of days ago, but chapter 22. Thank you. It's known as the Taylor Lapse. I've never typed anything in my life that didn't have a bunch of mistakes on it. And I'm a fellow who won the Remington Award 2 years in high school. None of the girls could type as fast as I could, even with my mistakes subtracted. But when I get typing for classes, I've always said, you don't go back and correct. You've got to get it done. And I get it done, believe it or not. I had a terrible thing happen when I was in the Army. I was typing up an accident report for an officer. They had to be exactly right. And really, he was supposed to do it himself, but I ran an information office, and he had handed it to me, and I wasn't objecting because too many objections to officerial demands are a way you don't make the next promotion list. So I was typing it, and he had spelled it. He said it was the truck that had turned over was a Ford Stake, B-O-Y-D-E. Well, I just typed it out, B-O-Y-D-E. I'm not an authority in mechanics. I didn't even have a driver's license in those days. I figured it was some type of truck. When the report went in, it came back from the quartermaster section with a big circle around the B-O-Y-D-E and a nasty note in the column. And the officer stormed into my headquarters, and he said, asked if I didn't know how to spell body, B-O-D-Y. I didn't know how to spell body. And I cheerfully smiled at him and picked up the original manuscript, and I said, yes, sir. I said, I know how to spell body, sir, but, sir, I just copied the report you wrote, sir, and here it is, B-O-Y-D-E, sir. So it was a question of who was dumber, see, who was dumber. And about that time, my commanding officer came in. He was a very hard fellow to live with. He came in and asked what I was doing. And so when I told him I was doing, then we both looked dumb. He denounced him and denounced me at the same time. So I concluded right then and there that in life, in typing, you have to make a certain number of mistakes. So make them with your friends. So every time you see a mistake in my notes here, you know I'm making it with my friends. Saving precision with those that hate me. Ah, yes, the Old Testament against its background. That's where we are as far as the course is concerned. I have tried to put my outline back on it. The writing gets poorer as the semester goes along. That's only because I really try to fake it at the start of the year with great neatness. And I'm becoming more normal now. Soon we write in small block letters with the left hand. But I'd like you to see where we're headed, especially since I don't have a syllabus in this course. I passed out a chart on the political background in the last class. If you were not here and missed that, I would be glad to give you one downstairs if you thought it to your advantage to have one. I passed it out, also gave out a volunteer assignment last week, which I will have a couple more somewhat later, but passed out a chart just showing how the political background went on this particular day and age. I think I need not lecture on this very much. If you took and compared what I call the running events column on the far right-hand side, if you compared that with the Roman procurators, which is the second column next to it after 6 AD. And you'd find an interesting thing there. You would find, you'd have to put them together, but you'd discover that there was hardly a procuratorship where there was not some rebellion by the Jews. You would discover that there was a continuous rebellious attitude in Palestine by the Jews. You discover that there was a considerable rebellion in the days of Pomponius, a huge breakout in the days of Gratus, a rebellion in the time of Marcellus, no physical rebellion in the time of Felix, but a lot of difficulties. Florus, the last of the Roman procurators, was a wicked, wicked rascal. That's all you can say about him. And the great rebellion to end all rebellions came in his day and age. But when you see the line of rebellions on the part of the Jews, then you suddenly get, maybe not sympathy, but you suddenly get a little feeling for the situation Pilate was in. Pilate had already, at the time Jesus was crucified, had a couple breakouts of rebellions by the Jews. Pilate knew what to do with them. He killed everybody. But he was already, had gone through a situation of rebellions of that sort. And although we can still think Pilate was woefully wrong in his whole concept towards the Lord, you can get a little feeling for the political intrigue in that particular day and age. His whole career eventually would end on another rebellion. Pilate saw four breakouts of major rebellions by the Jews during his procuratorship. So you get a feeling that Palestine was a place, in part at least, of almost perpetual strife. Now, some people lived there and lived from their youth to their old age and never really saw much, but a place where there was always potential strife, always potential strife, and between either the Roman zealots, the Greek Hellenists, or people along that particular line. I had offered at the start of this a notation in this middle section on how Herod's kingdom broke down, how his kingdom broke down, the threefold division under this Palestinian control note. I think I will not elaborate on that, but you will discover that it was all rather restored to one headship, all restored to one headship, about 48 B.C. It all came back to one thing, in which the real force was the Roman procurator. So I've tried to do those with two parenthetical remarks. It perhaps is not terribly necessary to know that stuff, but Tenney goes over it in considerable detail, too, in the framework of the text. But it gives you a feeling for the political background if you have a bit of it in the circumstance in which you are. You'll discover that when the Lord moved from territory to territory, he was actually moving from the territory where one man had control, only two really in his day, to another. And the rivalry between the two was such that that anything could provoke a fight almost at any given moment. As Tenney mentions, Philip was the only really decent, he's number one on my list, the only really decent of all the Herods. Now, Philip was a rather decent fellow. But the Herodian family, apart from Philip, were known for treachery and murders and persecutions and bigamies and more things than you can shake a stick at. Philip seems to have been the decent Herod, and nothing ill is ever said of him in Scripture. He's only mentioned a couple of times. Nothing ill is mentioned to him in Scripture, and so forth. So I just mentioned those things as an historic background in the political setting. I'm not going to bug you much more about the political setting than just the material that I have here. And I don't know, you can say tons and tons of stuff, but I will just kind of leave it like it is. It gives you a feeling that the Roman See were the big overall rulers. They looked for some local leadership to rule in their stead. That's how they kept world revolution from it. And the people who wanted the approval of Rome constantly vied with one another. There was a constant jealousy between them as to whom the Roman emperor would support. But the theory in Rome was this: as long as they are arguing among themselves, they are not arguing with us. And that's just kind of the way it went. So the Romans would give their favor to one leader for one period and to another leader for another period. Other than those things, I know not what to tell you. I had pulled down this map, kind of crudely, slightly futile, but I pulled it down anyway. I may as well pull it a step further. It's really too far from you to note it. So I note that the map on the centerfold in Tenney's book is probably better for you. But to have some idea of where all these territories and all of these particular things happen to be, and what they happen to be doing in them. This one's a little better. You may be able to see it. Well, it's considerably better, in fact. If you can transpose it on this one to get a total world view of the whole, you'll be better off. This one, I think, is colored, isn't it? Or
shaded or something, so that you can have some advantage of the general territory, and you can pick up Philip up in here and Herod here, and the territories of Amathus, which he kind of forfeited over beyond that. So you get a feeling for the whole thing on his governmental background. It's not a very big country. It's big, though, maybe if you live there and have to walk from end to end, but we are either blessed or cursed. I don't know what the case is, but we are blessed in living in a very big country. And it's hard to believe how small most countries of the world are. Russia's large, China's large, Brazil is large, Australia's large. Most countries are small. Canada's whopping big, but most countries are small. And I remember when we were in Netherlands years ago, one of the world tours. I had a couple days when I didn't have to work, and so I wanted to go and see the place that Cornelius Vormerdam and these fellows have in the Netherlands. And so I went to the railroad station to get a ticket. I had a terrible time telling him what I wanted to go to. Of course, his English was non-existent, and my Dutch was non-existent, so we kind of poked at each other humorously. But eventually I showed him the place on the map, and he looked at it, and then he looked back at me. And in effect, he said, the lady came up and helped a bit. He said, oh, he said, that's too far for one day. He said, that's all the way to Germany, he said. He said, too far, too far. Now, I mean, if I'd wanted to go there to stay, he'd have sold me a ticket, but I wanted to go and come back, so he wanted to go in the morning and come back. He said, too far. He said, all the way to Germany, he said. And, of course, that gave me a feeling, you know, of defeat, so I went out, and the Hardings and I went down that day and looked at them building the new dikes along the ocean. But 2 days later, I discovered that all the way to Germany was 38 miles. So if you live in a big country like this, you're not prepared for distances. All of Palestine, by our standards, is a small country. A small country. But a country full of strife and full of hate in the days of which we speak. The chief thing that you pick up from knowing the political background, the chief thing that you pick up, you learn why the Jews could not kill Christ. That's such a little thing, but and you already know that, no doubt. You learn why the Jews could not kill Christ. You learn why they couldn't kill Paul. You learn why they couldn't just assassinate the whole Christian movement. You learn that they did not have the power of death. Even Herod. Now, Herod was a murderer, and Herod found a lot of ways to get rid of people. But even Herod, when it was an official, could not sentence him to death. He had to send him to the Roman legate for the death sentence. Even when he was called king of all Judea, I'm speaking of Herod the Great, to get a death sentence, he had to have a trial before a Roman legate. Usually had to send them up into what we would call modern Asia Minor today for that kind of a thing. So you discover that the total powers were considerably limited. Rome held the power of life and death, held the power of taxation, held the power of promotion. Local government held about everything else. Mr. Yeske.
Well, in view of that, how did, or don't we know, how did Rome view what happened with all the children under 2 years old?
Basically speaking, if he could get away with it. See, nobody cares for a kid. Basically speaking, I'm just saying that in a political sense. Basically speaking, nobody cares for a kid. If he could get away with it, Rome didn't care. But when it came to like a high priest or an official who might incite somebody, then something had to be done. It had to be done legally. So you had in the Roman Empire, like you have in some other governments too, a two level of doing things. One, what you can get away with, and two, what is right. Now, the what is right comes to be important when persons of prominence and whatnot are involved, or when some issue has to be made where you need to be justified. But Herod the Great, he was undoubtedly an old, well, in the circumstances in which he operated with the Bethlehem, there probably were not many to start with. It was probably local, it probably was not widely known, there probably was no great Jewish outcry. Herod the Great planned a much worse thing than that, you know. He planned on the day of his death to have all the leaders of Judah killed. He had them all gathered together for a big festival for several days, and the plan was the day he died, they were all to be killed, murdered by his soldiers, so that there would be mourning in the land on the day of his death. But he was weak and intransigent in the last couple of days of his life, and his wife let them go. If he'd known that, there would have been one less wife. But so generally speaking, what they could get away, what was legal was one thing, what they could get away with was another thing. And Herod, of course, murdered outright his own brothers, and his mother, too. His mother, too, he murdered.
The thing that determined whether or not they got away with it was whether or not people rose up in revolt.
and whether the person that they killed had a friend in the Roman Senate. That's right, you know, that would call for an inquiry. But here in the case of Christ, with many followers and with a kind of a public image, of course the Lord's hand was in all these things too, but they had to get the approval of the Romans for that particular act. They had to get the Romans to do it. And likewise, later on in the case of Paul, although you remember that there were a group of men who had taken a pledge that they would kill Paul. They were not thinking in terms of court trial, they were thinking in terms of murder. But you learn those things out of the political background, if you don't learn much else. I want to say a few words about the cultural background. The cultural background. Society in general, it's hard to know what to say, but society in general was a poor man's society in Palestine of the Lord's day. The poor were numerous. They are called the poor of the land in rabbinical culture. They were numerous. And certain communicable diseases were widespread among them. As far as we can tell, leprosy was the great wicked disease, but not nearly so common. As far as we can tell, tuberculosis and certain eye diseases really raged in the ancient world. Tuberculosis must have killed millions of people. It had all sorts of other intensifications in the Roman culture, but health was not a great thing. The life expectancy in the Roman Empire at the time of Julius Caesar, 49 B.C., 50 B.C., it might have improved a little in Jesus' day, but the life expectancy in that time was 19 years. It was expected that you might live 19 years. Now, there were lots of people who lived to be old, 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 but the birth rate out of children was, on the whole, a mortality rate of 1 out of 3 at birth. So, consequently, life was thought of rather cheaply in society. The whole culture of the Roman Empire was essentially a slave state. There were free citizens, but there were not many. In proportion, there were 4 slaves, we have an estimate, in 0000 in the time of Christ, in Rome, in the Roman Empire. In Rome itself, an average of 4 slaves for every free man. Now, in Palestine, that ratio would be somewhat different, because the Palestinians were a conquered people. They were not slaves or Romans. They were barbarians. They were no class types. So in Palestine, the Jews were neither slaves nor Romans. They were subjects to the army. There were exceptions, like Paul, who, because of his birth in Tarsus, was a citizen. Tarsus had a unique status. Long, complicated history there, too. But Tarsus had a unique status. Many people think that the favors by Octavius Caesar to Tarsus gave Roman citizenship to its parties. It's hard to prove that, but many think that. Some have thought that maybe Paul's father had bought citizenship. If you bought citizenship for yourself, it could be conferred to your sons. Freedom could be passed on. So the exact reason for Paul's citizenship is not known to us. I lean to the Tarsus favor from Octavian's view. But it's not exactly known to us. What is known is that he was a citizen. And the Roman captain, you just don't take the word of a bum when he says he's a citizen. The Roman captain received his word and knew that he was a citizen when he said it. And since he identifies himself with Tarsus, I go back to the imperial freedom given to that city by Octavian many years before. But whatever the case might be, citizenship was not common. Slavery was common. And a great many people like the Hebrews. By and large, the moral structure of society in the days of Christ was debased. I search for the right word. I hate to be vulgar about it, see, but we are prone to think that our own society is becoming morally decadent. It certainly is. But we are still about 200 notches on the gun above society in the Lord's time. And we're about 400 above the Middle Ages. We have got a long way to fall to become as immoral and illicit as life was in 1200 and 1300 AD. Just for those who think we've already hit the bottom. I've had people say, well, it can't get much worse. And the historian knows that it's been 100 times worse. And it might go all that route, I hate to tell you. I hate to think of my children and their children.
if the Lord doesn't wrap these things up. But it has been bad, and it will be like that again, I think, without any doubt. I think we see evidence of that great decadence, hovering over us at all times. But culturally, in the Lord's day, morality was just a very, very much of a lost art. Now, there was a higher moral structure in Palestine than there was in Rome because of the culture of the Jews. No question about that at all. But even there, see, it was a striking thing. Yes, sir. It seems to have been throughout. In Rome it was throughout, no question. And it seems to have been throughout pretty uniformly. We know more about Rome and Greece than we do, for example, about North Africa. Palestine was a cut above it, but it seems to have been throughout. Even in Palestine, though, the immorality situation was pretty pronounced. And I offer to you the example of the woman taken in adultery brought to the Lord Jesus. I'm not a very original thinker myself, but I suffered for years in classes under David Hedegaard, the Swedish scholar. He was a real scholar. His Swedish accent was almost the end of me on many a time. When he said that Bultmann, according to Bultmann, he said, the New Testament is full of myths, tales, and legends. Myths, tales, and legends. Myths, tales, and legends. I never quite got over that, say, but someone said to Hedegaard, they said, how much do we really know of the moral situation of Palestine? We know a great deal through the rabbis who wrote and what they wrote against. That's how you learn it. But he said, of the woman taken in adultery. He said, why did they bring her to the Lord Jesus when Moses said they both should be stoned? He said, do you think they'd already stoned a man? The answer was no, he's one of their own boys. Who knows? But the fact of the matter is, if someone is taken in the very act of adultery, they're not taken by themselves. You all are smart enough to know that without any elaboration. But the morality level of Palestine had come to be a very, very partial and prejudicial thing. And so I think I will not elaborate on that. I hate to think about poor morals under any circumstance, but the world was really just not a very good place. If we went into a long discussion of how the Romans treated slaves, it's just not very good to think about. But a Roman master could kill a slave for no other reason than the fact that he wanted to. Now, many of them didn't, of course. It's unproductive. They cost too much money at the local. But if it was possible. And they were very fond of treating rebellious slaves with a system of chaining them to a dead body, letting them go about chained face-to-face with a corpse. In Rome, it was a grisly thing to chain two slaves together and kill one of them, see, and let the other fellow live with it, as the case might be. So ghastly that our minds and our culture cannot really think about it. Some of those things form interesting background pictures for the New Testament expressions of Paul in the Corinthian letters and so forth, which you will come on in due time. In Palestine society, and probably in Rome too, but that's beyond our bounds right now, there was a great deal of press towards what we would call the trades, the crafts. There was not much big industry, but a great thrust towards the trades and the crafts. Now, the Jewish culture in particular had the concept that every young man should know a trade. I still kind of lean that way. I kind of think that it's good, whatever else you do, to have some manual cultural skill, manual or cultural. If you sew clothes, that's not too manual, but that's plenty cultural. But I still kind of think it's a good idea to have some type of a trade background, just in case. I'm glad to have a couple trade certificates, just in case. I'm not anxious to go back to Europe either, but just in case. The Jews lined them up, you know. They lined the professions up into an arrangement of the professions that were honorable, the professions that were questionable, and the ones that were dishonorable. Not dishonorable because they were immoral or anything of that sort, but dishonorable because of the nature of them. And it was an unhappy Jewish family when they decided that the only thing their son could do successfully was to be a tanner. A tanner was one of the dishonorable professions. Now, by that, see, I don't mean there was anything morally wrong with it, but it was a stinky job. Consequently, to think that your son would spend the rest of his life working with the fluids at the time, and your daughter comes home and says, Mother, I've fallen in love with a tanner. And immediately, a great groan goes through the house, an undesirable profession of the worst sort. And if she comes home and says, "Mother, I've fallen in love with a jewel cutter," everybody rejoices. Not that he is any wealthier or any better, but it's a position of refinement. So the Jews rated all the professions socially, see, and had them like that. Fisherman was not very high on the list either. I mean, see, when I say dishonorable, I don't mean there was anything wrong with it, except the nature of the work. Fisherman was not very high on the list, but tanner was the way down near the bottom of the thing. So we've often said that when Peter was sent to the house of Simon the tanner, he must have swallowed twice and said, "Well, I know that this is a new age. I know that there's something different here." He must have gulped twice. See. But in Palestine, there was great emphasis put on the trades and the crafts and skills along that line. In education, there certainly was nothing in education of the universal sort that we press today. But in Palestine, there were schools at almost every synagogue. Almost every synagogue possessed a school. I will say more about it later. But where the Jewish children, up to a given point, learned to read and write, if they didn't learn it at home, the Jews were rather literate and learned something of the Torah and the traditions of the people, right?
Is it both for the boys and girls?
No, largely the boys. The Jewish girls on the whole received only schooling at home, such as it was. But we understand that some of them were rather literate too. Dr. Cohen had a long list of quotes. I'll have to bring them out and read them someday. They used to make the New Testament class chuckle with great fervor. They used to make the men chuckle with great fervor. They used to make the ladies burn slowly. I'll see if I can find his list. Rabbi so-and-so said that the person who was worse than a dog was a man who taught Torah to a woman. Bible, woman, scriptures. He was worse than a dog. And the man who taught his wife to write, I forget what he was like, but he was really, really abominable. Then he would read some, after he got through reading those, he'd read some other rabbis that said nice things. You discover that the rabbis rarely agreed in unanimity on anything. So a Hebrew who wanted to do almost anything could find some rabbi to support him, and somebody that didn't like him could find some rabbi to speak against him. But mostly the education of that line was for the men. Now, the Roman Empire also had no compulsory education. Now, there were a number of schools. Roman schools were called the Ludus, or Ludi, if you make more than one, L-U-D-U-S. They were very, very basic schools. But most of the education of an educatable sort was conducted by private teachers who founded their own schools and had their own group of followers. So Paul came to Jerusalem sometime as a young man, apparently, and studied in the famous traditional school that he talks about in the book of Acts. He studied with the famous Jewish masters in Jerusalem or in Palestine, certainly. So most of the higher schooling was done by individuals who founded a school and kind of passed you around, or by the master of a craft. If you wanted to study medicine, you found one of the skilled physicians of his day and apprenticed yourself to him, and you'd have 2 years of Band-Aid application, 2 years of ungoutine rubbing, and eventually. Some of the surgeons, some of the physicians in the better days of Rome were very much advanced. They were advanced far above the Middle Age physicians. Some of them were, and probably some of them weren't. But they had all sorts, too, you'll be glad to know. They had chiropractors, naturopaths, all kinds of guys. I forget his name right now, but I think maybe Tenney mentions them. I don't know. If you read five or six books, I don't remember who mentions what, but one chap had listed 600 herbs and their curative powers. Just about everything fell within the scope of them. You could find them, you know. So they were really advanced in some ways. But education was pretty much along that line. No general compulsory education. No general. The Jewish culture pushed it pretty hard for their boys, especially because of the importance of Torah and synagogical services. Professional teachers, such as we who teach in a school like this, were almost unknown. The teachers in Roman Empire were largely slaves, cultured slaves that they'd stolen from someplace. And they would be slave to a household, they would be the pedagogue, the teacher for the children, and if the master liked them well, they might be the slave teacher for 50 or 60 others. Most of what we would call professional teachers were men who organized the school. They went out, they didn't hire 10 other guys, they didn't need them. They organized the school and people came and studied with them. But professional teachers such as we have today were virtually unknown. Most of the rabbis were teachers, and many of the Pharisees, like Gamaliel and whatnot, were also teachers, but not in the formal sense that we think of it today, where, you know, you say, well, I work at the University of Jerusalem. The rabbinical schools largely were headed up in a synagogue under the rabbi on duty or on call at the time. And he was chiefly not thought of as a teacher. He was chiefly thought of as an actuary in the services. Yes, sir.
When they call a certain man a doctor of the law and what have you, is that a degree of a type, or is that just a title here?
You mean in the New Testament, like when the Lord speaks of Nicodemus, that's just an expression. That's not a degree. It's just an expression. As far as we know, just an expression.
When these professional teachers organized the school around themselves and taught, did they do it professionally as a living?
Yes, they charge the fee of the students. They charge the fee or a service of the students. And the earliest Christian schools did that too. You could go to Alexandria and study with Clement, either for paying money or for a service. A service might be getting his breakfast every morning, but for money or a service. Yeah. There were no state subsidies, and it was a long time till you got any church subsidies, but that will show up in time. So I will say no more about that. I have the word theory here because I got tired of writing early in the business, and it's apparently written on a thumbprint, so it's blotted out somewhat. But what I mean by that is the theoretical inclinations of that time, the philosophical wanderings, the theoretical implications of that age, the New Testament age. May I mention four of them quickly? The theoretical inclinations, the ruling philosophies. You could mention a dozen, but may I mention four quickly? Platonism was the dominant philosophy among the big heads, among the big scholars, Platonism, after Plato. It never had much of a grip on the people. It's a high and lofty type thing that a poor farmer can't understand. When it comes to philosophy, that's basically what I am. I'm a poor farmer. And when we get later on in other courses that I have to teach, I enjoy teaching. When we get into courses where we have to discuss realism and nominalism and Occam's razor and all those things, I feel like burying the book and going back and growing cabbages. It seems to me that there must be something much more worthwhile doing in life than worrying about how many spirits can stand on which end of the pin. But philosophy, you know, the theoretical inclinations are attempts to explain your existence. Because they're attempts to explain your existence in the light of the world as you see it. And Platonism was one of those. Plato, if you're a philosophy major in college, you may hate me when I get finished with this sentence, eh? But Plato felt that the only things that were real were the ideas, the ideals or the ideas. He felt that they were real, and he felt that they had an objective reality, but we could not know what it was. So somewhere back in the cave, we say humorously, all Platonic scholars understand that, somewhere back in the cave, was the idea of a real chair. But in your life, you would see anything from like the thing you're sitting on now to a milking stool to a barbershop chair to the lazy boy recliner that you study in on Sunday afternoon for about 5 minutes. That's how long it takes to fall asleep in one of those crazy things, see? Well, Plato would say none of those is the real chair. None of those is the real chair. But there is a real image, a real idea of a chair somewhere, and each of those has a little bit embodied in it. Consequently, all of these expressions are not real. They are just pictures or impressions of the real thing. And so the Platonic world was a very high-minded kind of world in which God was an impersonal but great good oversoul type of thing. I was telling the church history class today about Neoplatonism, a kind of a super development on this. But the Platonic ideal was very big. It came into Judaistic culture largely through Philo of Alexandria. Philo was rather amazingly Platonic. Knowledge, then, see? The more knowledge you have, the more likely you are to be saved. I mean, the man who only knows there's one chair, he's hopelessly lost. He looks around and he says, well, this is the only chair. He's hopelessly lost. He can't, only knowing one chair, he can't know anything of the ideal. But if you know 1,000 chairs, and if you can study them analytically, you may be able to know something a little more definitively of what the real chair is like. And if you know enough, you may be saved, see? Not saved from hell, but saved from ignorance, which is the real killer. But if you know enough, you may be So you can see that Platonism never could appeal to the general masses very much. Because unless you had the opportunity of culture and study and learning and all those things, how many chairs could you see in your life? And a chair may be a poor illustration, but the Platonic philosophy never appealed to many people beyond a few scholars and theoretical people whose fathers were rich and could send them to school forever. Because it just wasn't a practical type of philosophy. But it tended to dominate the mind. And eventually, with things like the cross, it would come to have a very bad influence. It would come to say, well, you know, the true cross cannot be that thing put on Calvary's Hill. The true cross has to be an idea behind the suffering of all mankind. And before long, Platonic influences in the church would deny the reality of sacrifice, the cross, and a lot of other things, because they would only be slight expressions of the big idea in the background. In addition to that, in theoretical inclinations, I usually mention Gnosticism rather quickly, too. Gnosticism, G-N-O-S-T-I-C-I-S-M, Gnosticism, where the appeal was on a superior knowledge, which was intuitively discerned. See, the Platonic knowledge was by observation and empirical things, the Platonic knowledge. Platonic knowledge, you line up all the chairs and study them all. Gnostic knowledge, you don't even have to see a chair. You sit in a room with your eyes closed in the dark and think beautiful thoughts. Intuitively learned. Superior knowledge intuitively learned. But usually not learned by yourself. Usually learned with the help of a special teacher who had gotten it from some powerful angel, who had gotten it from some detached god. Now, the Gnostic world was in three big compartments. There was heaven, that was one compartment, and there was earth, that obviously is another compartment. And in between heaven and earth was what many Gnostic scholars referred to as the Pleroma, P-L-E-R-O-M-A, the Pleroma, which is everything between earth and heaven, Pleroma. And if you can imagine such a ridiculous picture, the Pleroma was full of bits of truth, like ions of nitrogen or something, but it was full of bits of truth. And the only way you could be blessed was if you could somehow reach up and absorb some of those things. Now, of course, if you came on the right teacher, he could help you. The right teachers were always Gnostic teachers. He could help you. Now, you will not see much in the Gospels that even sounds like a challenge by Gnosticism at all. Some people think John, in the light and darkness thing, has a Gnostic imagery in mind, and he's fighting against it. But you will, in the epistolatory literature in the New Testament, you will see a lot of incidental references to ideas that are kind of like Gnosticism. As I often mention in church history, the best single passage in the New Testament to see it is in Colossians 2. Where there are three or four ideas that are distinctly Gnostic, which are pronounced bad, and you shouldn't be involved with them. So it will show up big there. I should mention also in this theoretical inclination bit, Stoicism. Again, if you've been a philosophy major, you may hate me for my analysis. It's a risk you run, Stoicism. Now, Stoics believed in no personal God. They believed in a great fate, a great blind fate. But they generally believed he was good, or it. They generally believed that that blind fate was benevolent and good rather than nasty and evil. Stoicism. S-T-O-I-C-I-S-M. The Stoics had that what will be, what is kind of a complex. It is not the providential trust of a Christian. It wasn't even the kismet of Mohammedanism. It was just the kind of a thing that there's a blind, benevolent fate that you can't do anything about, so you might as well be cheerful. Stoics tended to be morally good because they felt that that fate was benevolent. And wherever they saw immorality, they felt it was contrary to faith. But again, see, Stoicism appealed to very few people. So in a nutshell, Platonism appealed to very few people because it was a brainy thing and one that required experience and a lot of ability to... And Gnosticism didn't appeal to very many because not many of us do well sitting in the dark thinking beautiful thoughts. And Stoicism, likewise, it doesn't help much. It never helped me much to say, so you've got a toothache. The whole world has toothaches. Don't cry. Never helped me a bit to say that everybody else had a toothache. And it probably didn't help. There are a few Stoics yet with us, but there are not very many. It was never a thing of big popular appeal. The most popular appeal, although it wasn't closely followed, was the fourth of these theoretical inclinations, and that was the Epicurean philosophy, which was kind of dying in New Testament days. In Acts 17, you'll see a few of the Epicureans and Stoics on Mars Hill. But Epicureanism was kind of dying. Epicureanism was a philosophy that really wasn't so religiously oriented, but a philosophy that thought that the greatest good was pleasant experiences. Pleasant experiences. So we often use the word hedonism with a H-E-D-O-N-I-S-M, hedonism. Pleasant experiences. Epicurus himself is a fellow that I've always felt some sympathy with in history. He was not a wild and licentious person. He was not a glutton or a drunkard. He was a guy who for 80 years, he lived about 80 years, about 300 B.C. and thereafter, he was a guy who for 80 years had constant digestive problems. Couldn't eat. He certainly didn't drink much. He brought it back. He couldn't eat. And consequently, he was, most of his lifetime, feeling sick. Now, I don't apologize for his flaw, but I can see how, you know, he kind of thought, boy, just to sit down once with a big steak. To sit down once with a big steak. Smothered with onions and mushrooms and garlic sauce, with about a spoonful of Tabasco sauce sprinkled lightly over the top of it. I can see how he must have in his heart, I get a little dramatic here unfortunately, but I can see how in his heart he must have said, what it must be to enjoy a good meal. So in his own mind, Epicurus said that the greatest possible good was personal pleasure. And he was not a wild living man. Some of his followers got to be that. But he himself wasn't. In fact, anything immoderate went contrary to pleasure, see. So if you went out and had a big blast, you'd be sick for a week, and that was just stupid, in Epicurus' view. You'll discover that there's a certain amount of Epicureanism in some aspects of Christianity. I'm always really appalled. I never know what to say either when somebody says, well, I was saved a year ago, and I'm happy every day. I'm glad if they're happy every day. But I don't personally want to have to walk around and keep a diary on them. Because the few people I've known who were happy every day, need I tell you? Because you might really be happy every day. I have satisfying days, but I have unhappy ones too. I've never said to somebody, trust the Lord and you'll always be happy. Or always be anything other than always be his. I think you can say that with a real measure of assurance. But some Christians suffer terribly, and some are happy through it, and some are sad through it. So that's one of those things. But the Epicurean philosophy was very big in Palestine. It was chiefly pushed by the Sadducees. Very big. It was dying in the empire, but very big because the Sadducees no longer believed in an afterlife. They didn't believe there was any accountability to God. They thought the best thing was to have a pleasant trip while you're here. So it was the Sadducees who pushed having the Olympic Games in Jerusalem. And you know, you can see the amphitheater, the Roman amphitheater, and Dr. Cohen's model. You've all seen Dr. Cohen's Jerusalem model back here. I'm sorry he's not here to lecture on it. I'm sorry he's not here to teach the course. But you can go in and look at the Jerusalem model and see the amphitheater, see. Although I really don't think that you need to know how many towers there were around Jerusalem to understand the New Testament. I don't think that's totally necessary. Now, the Sadducees pushed that because the Sadducees were pleasure-oriented. The Pharisees were quite different. But the Sadducees were Epicurean in a philosophic sense, pleasure-oriented. Might as well enjoy yourself while you're here because you're not going to be anyplace else. And I suppose if that were right, why, they would be right too in a sense, in a restricted sense. But Epicureanism was dying. I think I said that about three times because largely it had fallen in Rome particularly in the hands of debauched people to whom pleasure was just licentious living. And the populace had turned from that. Now I sketched these four things. You could sketch about six more, but I sketched these four things just for one big point. And that is that in the great masses of the world, in the first century A.D., there was a great vacuum in the soul. Just a great vacuum. The rank and file of the people had nothing which they held as their own. in a sense of a philosophical or worldview entity. The great rank and file of them had nothing. There was a great vacuum. It was more true in the first century AD, probably, than it had been true for 500 years. And of course, it's hard to speak after that because the church came with a saving message. But a great vacuum. The older religions looked abortive. The philosophies were not in keeping with the step of mind of the people. And in a general sense, a great vacuum in the mind. That's an enormously important fact as far as the New Testament age is concerned. Of course, when Paul goes to Athens, they want to hear if there's any new thing. That's all they do is sit in the hill. But you have to understand again that that was not the mass of Athenian citizens. That was a cultivated group that the populace supported either through teaching their education and whatnot. But they could well sit there and look to hear some new thing. And maybe that described the attitude of much of the town. And in that sense, of course, they were willing to hear Paul, and some actually believed, although many doubted, and some said maybe later we'll hear more, but some actually believed. But a great vacuum in Rome and in the East. The church, even though it was illegal, and even though you could be killed for being a believer in the next century, would grow like a bad weed, because, among other things, it had a message that cut across all classes, free men, slaves, rich and poor, and filled the vacuum. The greatest minds are not bored with the Christian message, but the simplest peasant can understand it well enough to be blessed and have light. So it would cut across the whole world with a message that would fill that vacuum. Mr. Platik.
There were religions, though, and cults floating around.
Yes.
Will you explain why they were aborted?
I will look at them under a religious background, if you'll forgive me, which is right there. Yeah, I'll attempt to explain it. Yeah. I wanted to say one word about the social activities in this cultural background. I always get carried away with this stuff. I'm about to fall half an hour behind the lesson plan. In 3 minutes, that's where I'll be. I'll be a half an hour down. How will I make it up? I'll either stop telling stories or not give the mid-semester exam. We'll wait and see when the time comes. We'll wait and see when the time comes. But you see, social life, particularly in Palestine, the Jews were anti-social life. Are you familiar with that? Except for the Sadducees. They were I don't mean anti-social life, I mean anti-parties, anti-games, anti-fun. The Hebrew culture, apart from the Sadducees, was anti-fun, period. They never participated in sports. It was counterproductive. The Pharisees denounced the coming of the Grecian games in language that you can hardly believe. Counterproductive. They produced no wrestlers, jumpers, basketball stars. The house of David would have been frowned on in all parts. They denounced the theater. The Hebrew culture existed on work, period, and worship, second period. But the rest of the world was fun-oriented. Theater, gladiatorial games, Olympics. So you've got a real contrast between the Hebrew world in its purest form and the rest of the world. As I've said about 8 times, the Sadducees were the bad ones in this. The Sadducees wanted the games. So they became the link in Hebrew culture and the rest of the world. But by and large, the Roman world was fun-oriented at anybody's expense. The early church would have a tough time determining whether they should follow the older Hebrew ideas or whether they should syncretize athletics, sports, and whatnot into their culture. If you've ever been to any of the banquets of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, you can see how it's gone. Today, if you're not about 6'2" and average 14.5 on the court, you're hardly meritorious of giving a testimony. Unless, of course, you play with the Buffalo Colts and broke 8 fellas' collarbones last year in violent collegiate. I speak as an athlete. But speaking as a teacher, I will see you on Friday.
Yes. Is there a shrinking Xerox around somewhere?
I don't think there is. On the premises, I'm sure there's not. Here, at school. Yeah. I have an electrostatic copier, but it doesn't shrink. It might expand a little.